Hello, today is September the 10th of 2026. We're starting off with part one of the Pantograph. My name is Kayla Verhoeven, and we will go ahead and talk about higher education. A good story, but is it true? Urban legends and ghost stories live on and on at ISU and IWU by D.Jack Alkire, Bloomington. The legend has it that the basement of 303 East Chestnut Street, the home of Illinois Wesleyan University's Phi Mu Alpha fraternity, houses a grave that can never be filled. The building has only had two owners, according to Diego Martinez, a senior at IWU, and the frat's former president. And it's said that the doctor who owned the house before them was rather strict with his adult daughter, especially when she started dating. This story goes that while the doctor still had this house, he had a daughter, Vera, Martinez said, standing inside the parlor or quote-unquote date room, and he would, when she was starting to court boys, he would bring them into the house, sit them down in this room, and they would have the windows open and everything, and he would put his shotgun right next to the fireplace, Martinez said. However, according to the stories, Vera never did move out of the house. She died either by her father's hand or other nefarious means and is buried in the basement, a grave that can never truly be covered up. This is just one of the tall tales the university campuses of Bloomington Normal share, including sinking buildings at Illinois State University, haunted theaters at both schools, and plans to interlock five different castles at campuses across the state. Every year, these stories are told to a new incoming class of freshmen and transfers, perpetuating their gravity and legacy. Setting the stage. People say that Agnie Milner, the first librarian on campus, still haunts the basement of Williams Hall, said Collins Dames, an admissions tour guide at ISU. Williams Hall was originally built as the first Milner Library, honoring Agnie Milner, and the rumor is that the librarian died while shelving books in the biology section. I've never been down there, Dames said. But that's kind of the big one that we always say on our tours. I'm not man enough to go down there. Don't like the idea of ghosts, but that's our big one. Well, lighthearted in nature, this story can detract from the impact Milner had on campus, said current ISU archivist April Anderson Zorn. Angeline Milner was a pioneer in the state for developing and running academic libraries. She taught herself how to catalog and then brought that skill and brought the library together. Five different separately run libraries on her campus and brought all of this together, Anderson Zorn said. She helped start Illinois Library Association. Besides that, though, construction on Williams Hall did not begin until years after Milner's death in 1928. It's not physically possible for Milner to have died there because she died 12 years prior to the opening of the building, she said. Unless they, dug up her corpse and threw her in there, and that's not going to happen. And then there's Cook Hall, or the castle. Cook Hall was built in the late 1890s and is one of five buildings at state institutions of higher education in Illinois to feature parapets and ramparts. The story is that they were originally planned as one building, but were broken up into five. There's a belief that Cook Hall, along with some other Illinois campuses, all have very similar looking buildings, that if you put them and all the plans together, it's like some sort of Voltron. They come together as one big giant castle, Anderson Zorn said. The truth is rather mundane by comparison, because the school secured state funding simply because the governor at the time, Joseph Altjed, really liked the Gothic Revival style of European universities and greenlit funding for the buildings. And there's the lady in red who haunts Kemp Hall on IWU's campus, said archivist Liz Bloodworth. The stories are that students have seen her. They call her the lady in red because they've often seen her in a red dress, perhaps getting ready to go to a ball or something, she said. There was a ballroom in that home on the third floor. Or there are three Franceses, supposedly three different women, all named Frances, who lived at IWU's Acacia House at one time or another, who died from tragic deaths and still haunt the house, Bloodworth said. Or back at ISU, the notion that the architect of Watterson Towers went insane and is buried underneath the building is something that is patently false, Zorn said. Tell the story. For folks like Dames, it can hurt to learn the cold truth. I guess I've been spreading false information, he said forlornly. New and seasoned Redbirds alike are crestfallen to hear that their beloved Watterson Towers is not, in fact, the tallest structure between Chicago and St. Louis, residential or otherwise. I thought that this was one of the big facts that they would say about all this, said Evan Ecker, an incoming freshman at Festival ISU on Tuesday, August the 26th. Watterson is 298.5 feet tall. The state capitol building is 60 feet taller, and Oak Brook Terrace in Oak Brook, Illinois, is 418 feet in height, making it the tallest residential structure outside Illinois' two major metropolitan areas, she said. But people keep telling the stories, even if they're far-fetched and hard to believe. It's culturally significant and is a way of storytelling, Ecker said. It helps to remember history in a way that is exciting and entertaining to people because it's a lot of fun to describe a half-truth and talk about Milner Library and then be able to discuss a historic fact. For Martinez, it's about finding a semblance of knowledge in a world full of unknowns. I think we're so fascinated because we want to have some answer or some story to questions that we can't, you know, wrap our heads around, he said, standing in the basement of his fraternity house. There's different things that occur in life that we just can't explain on our own. Either way, we don't have the information or we don't have the understanding of the times to really know exactly what happened. We really want the story and we want to be able to share these experiences that people have had. And maybe it ties us to the past in some way. Those ties exist because often there's a grain of truth to them. Phi Mu Alpha purchased the house at 303 East Chestnut Street in the late 1920s, Martinez said. According to archived articles from the Pantograph, a Dr. Ernest Mammon owned the home in the late 1800s. His son, Dr. Ernest Mammon Jr., took control of the house in the 1900s. And Mammon Jr. had several children, one being a daughter named Vera, born in 1879. She died, quote-unquote, in the prime of her life, according to the Wednesday, April 7th, 1920 edition of the Pantograph, in Pekin, where she lived with her husband and her five children. Moving on now, ruling is due soon on aid to dying law. Illinois, Hannah Meisel, Capital News, Illinois, 2 hours ago. Chicago, Illinois is set to become the first Midwestern state to allow terminally ill adults to take life-ending medication prescribed by physicians when the law goes into effect late this week. But a federal judge is weighing whether to block the End of Life Options for Terminally Ill Patients Act, or EOLA, from its September 12th operative date after hearing arguments Friday in a lawsuit that alleges that EOLA discriminates against people with disabilities. The suit also claims that the law runs afoul of federal law, including the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Affordable Care Act. Thomas Geohagan, who represents the disability rights groups, physician, and disabled Illinoisans who brought the case, told U.S. District Judge John Tharp that the law upends the millennial-old tradition of Hippocratic Oath, a pledge doctors make to, quote-unquote, first do no harm. As a result, Geohagan argued, EOLA will result in the severe impairment of the relationship a patient with disabilities has with his or her physician. It's our view, ultimately, this is authorizing a different standard of care, he said. Disability rights advocates fiercely oppose the 2-year effort to pass this law, warning that physician bias as perceived quality of life may make doctors more inclined to encourage life-ending treatment over other options for people with disabilities. On Friday, Geohagan contended that this risk of coercion could be exacerbated by the reality of the American healthcare system, in which people with disabilities are often also poor or on public aid. Other countries that allow medical aid in dying, like Canada and some of Europe, have socialized medicine systems, he pointed out. It's a whole different bag in the United States, Geohagen said, because you can go out into the street right now and run into someone who's a defendant in a medical debt case. A whole lot of Americans are uninsured or underinsured. But the attorney defending EOLA on behalf of the state argued that the law contains a key stopgap. Physicians are only allowed to discuss lethal options with a terminally ill patient if the patient is one who brings it up. EOLA only applies to adults with less than 6 months to live, a prognosis that must be confirmed by two independent physicians. Patients must request lethal medication both verbally and in writing, and doctors are required to inform them of alternative hospice care and pain control options. Additionally, a patient requesting the medication must pass a mental evaluation by a physician to determine that they are mentally capable of making the decision and not facing undue influence. Patients must also be physically able to self-administer this medication. But when Geohagen argued that the law doesn't require enough state oversight to the doctors determining whether a patient is a candidate for medical aid in dying, a term that proponents of the law often use. Opponents, which also include religious groups like the Catholic Conference of Illinois, prefer to describe it as quote-unquote assisted suicide, because EOLA doesn't contain an objective state-engaged standard for doctors to make those determinations, Geohagen told the judge, that the law amounted to a violation of due process rights for people with disabilities. Tharp asked Elizabeth Morris, a high-ranking litigator in Attorney General Joaquim Raul's office, to respond to Geohagen's argument that EOLA lacks a process to assess the validity and legitimacy of actions that might be taken under the statute. I would argue that Act itself sets forth this very thorough process to slow things down and give doctors the opportunity to assess patients, Morris said, noting that doctors are trained to walk patients through informed consent, which she also said is quote-unquote explicitly spelled out in the law. And because doctors are responsible to the state, both to maintain their medical license and under medical malpractice law, Morris argued Illinois has already put these guardrails in place. Tharp said he would make a decision on whether to grant the preliminary injunction before the September 12th effective date. Another challenge is pending. In a separate challenge to EOLA filed last month by religiously affiliated healthcare systems and doctors, another federal judge in Chicago approved a temporary restraining order agreed to by all parties. The stipulated TRO exempts the plaintiffs from having to discuss lethal medication with patients until the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decides a case concerning similar themes. In that case, stemming from a 2016 law requiring that if requested by the patient, providers who don't perform abortions must refer, transfer, to or give patients written information about providers who do. A federal judge in Rockford issued a mixed ruling in this case last year, which the parties swiftly appealed. The appellate panel heard arguments this spring and could issue a ruling any time now. Democratic lawmakers pushed EOLA through to a passage in October, and Governor J.B. Pritzker signed it into law in December. The statute is also referred to as quote-unquote Deb's Law, named for former social worker Deb Robertson, a Lombard resident living with an aggressive case of neuroendocrine carcinoma. In her arguments Friday, Morris noted the multi-year effect by advocates to fill the gap in end-of-life care options in Illinois, asserting that public interest in denying the motion for a preliminary injunction here is strong. Capital News Illinois is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service that distributes state government coverage to hundreds of news outlets statewide. It is funded primarily by the Illinois Press Foundation and the Robert R. McCormick Foundation. Now, on to some world news. U.S. and Iran attacks on ships spike. The biggest wave of strikes so far in the war drive up oil. By Ines Alsray, Idris Ali, and Jana Chokir. 2 hours ago, Middle East, Cairo. Iran said Wednesday that it attacked 10 ships near the Strait of Hormuz after the U.S. sank 5 Iranian oil tankers in the biggest declared wave of attacks on shipping by both sides since the start of the war. The attack sent the price of oil surging, with benchmark Brent crude futures breaching $100 a barrel for the first time since July. At least one seafarer aboard a tanker was reported killed, and another listed as missing. Iran also said it had fired ballistic missiles at a base used by U.S. forces in Jordan. Attacks by both sides since the end of August have shattered a month of relative calm, with the U.S. and Iran hitting military ships and energy assets. The Revolutionary Guards said they would sharply escalate their response to further attacks, hitting 20 targets if the enemy struck 2 or 3. Iran would soon release maps of a new enlarged off-limits zone at sea that would extend as far as Chabahar at the far reaches of Iran's coast near Pakistan, that the guards said. In recent days, they have also seen an escalation in fighting between Saudi Arabia and the Houthis in Yemen, a second theater of war that threatens global energy supplies from the Middle East. The video shows Iranian tankers ablaze. The Americans said that they have destroyed 5 Iranian oil tankers overnight, releasing video of ships ablaze before they sank. The U.S. Military Central Command called its attacks a response to Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps that were targeting a U.S. Navy warship twice with ballistic missiles over the previous 2 days. No Americans were harmed, the United States said. Washington has announced a new policy of attacking Iranian tankers in retaliation for fire that threatens its warships and says it hit 10 so far over the past week. Iran continues to try to hit U.S. naval ships, and for every time they do that they try or do that, they're going to lose tankers, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio told reporters during a visit to Colombia. Iran said it fired on 2 U.S. ships and 8 tankers in response. One seafarer was killed aboard the oil products tanker Hercules Star while at anchorage off Dubai, and another crew member was missing. The vessel's charterer, Peninsula, said maritime security sources said that it may have been hit by a drone. The British Maritime Security Agency UKMTO described a vessel in the vicinity that was listing, possibly taking on water, after being struck by a projectile. They could not immediately determine whether this referred to the same ship. 2 Iraq port officials said a tanker carrying 2 million barrels of fuel oil, the New Andros, caught fire after being struck by a drone in Iraqi waters. There were no reports of casualties among the 22 crew. The Iraqi government confirmed the incident and said the tanker had been used for storage. The UKMTO said it received reports of several merchant ships struck by disabling fire in the northern Gulf and Gulf of Oman, on either side of the strait. Iran also threatened oil tankers in Kuwaiti and Bahraini ports, according to a statement carried by state media. A maritime security source reported a liquefied natural gas tanker was damaged in the Emirati port of Khorfakin. The IRGC also said Wednesday that it fired ballistic missiles at a base that was used by U.S. forces near Al-Azraq in eastern Jordan. Jordan said its air defenses intercepted 18 of the 20 Iranian missiles, with 2 falling harmlessly in unpopulated areas. A U.S. official said Iran's strikes in Jordan were ineffective and all American troops were accounted for. The strait got choked off. In recent weeks, Washington boasted of increasing success guiding tankers through the strait, which carried a fifth of oil supplies before the war. But any such gradual reopening appears to have been set back by a resumption of fighting this month. Claudio Galimberti, Chief Economics at consultancy Rystad Energy, said flows through Hormuz fell back as low as 2 million barrels a day and has reached as high as 8 million to 9 million BPD in the week before fighting resumed on August the 30th. Even more severe, the rise in crude prices have been a surge in the cost of fuels refined from it. The politically sensitive average retail price of U.S. diesel hit a fresh all-time high Wednesday, above $5.94 a gallon. Gasoline is also more expensive than ever at this time of the year. Escalating combat between Saudi Arabia and the Iran-aligned Houthi movement that controls most populated parts of Yemen has created additional uncertainty for energy markets. On Tuesday, the Houthis launched an attack on four cities in Saudi Arabia, causing huge fires visible from space at oil installations. Saudi authorities said 73 people were wounded. The Saudi press agency released footage showing homes damaged and injured patients in the hospital. Saudi authorities announced alerts Wednesday in two of the cities hit the previous day, but later said the threat had passed. A Saudi-backed government based in the south of Yemen has launched a multi-pronged assault on areas controlled by the Houthis, who have threatened Saudi shipping in the Red Sea. And now, some government politics, a top story spotlight. Normal O'Kay's $1.19 million Constitution Trail Bridge in Advance's Rab Road TIF process by Matus Janik 20 hours ago. Normal. The Normal Town Council on Wednesday approved a $1.19 million contract to replace the Constitution Trail pedestrian bridge over Linden Street and began creating a tax increment financing district along Rab Road. Mayor Chris Coos was absent from the brief meeting, and Council Member Kevin McCarthy presided. Bridge replacement. The council awarded Stark Excavating Incorporated a $1,192 contract to replace the 141-foot bridge, which was built in 1989. Inspections began in 2024 and identified localized bending, bulging, and a fatigue crack in preliminary structure member, according to council documents. Engineers also found that the bridge had more side-to-side movement than allowed. And excuse me, that was a Stark Excavating Incorporated $1,192,085. Moving on, Farnsworth Group evaluated repair options and determined that they would not provide a practical long-term solution. The existing bridge will continue to be monitored until replacement work is completed. The new bridge will be made with a prefabricated steel truss with a 10-foot wide trail deck, new bicycle and pedestrian railings, and an integrated LED lighting system, according to council documents. The revised profile also improves accessibility and provide over 17 feet of clearance over Linden Street. Construction is expected to begin in spring of 2027, with the completion expected by June the 30th of 2027. The Constitution Trail will be detoured during construction, and the specification limits to closure are no more than 60 consecutive days. The bridge itself has an estimated fabrication lead time of 6 to 8 months. Rab Road TIF District. In other news, the council also set a public hearing on the proposed Business 51 and West Rab Road TIF District for 6:50 p.m. on November the 2nd. The proposed district would cover about 215 acres and 94 parcels, generally bounded by Interstate 55 to the north, North Linden Street to the east, and Fairview Street to the south, and Northbrook Drive to the west. The area includes commercial properties, multifamily residential areas, public and semi-public land, vacant parcels, and about 20 acres of undeveloped land near Interstate 55 and Linden Street. In the TIF district, property tax revenue increases generated by improvements in the district are diverted from taxing bodies into a fund for redevelopment of the district. The town held an informational public meeting on the proposal August the 28th, but no members of the public attended, according to council documents. One parcel was removed from the proposed boundaries after the property owner contacted the town. The council could consider adopting the TIF district in early 2027 after the public hearing and review by a joint review board. ISU Fire Protection. In another vote, the council authorized a one-year agreement with the Illinois State University for fire protection services. The university will pay the town $720,075, which reflects a 5% increase from the previous year's $685,320 agreement. The agreement covers the period from July 1st of 2026 through June 30th of 2027. Payment is still contingent on the governor signing the state's fiscal 27 board appropriation bill. We have a top story spotlight in education. McLean County Unit 5 files request to intervene in Rivian appeal by Drew Zimmerman 19 hours ago. Bloomington. McLean County Unit 5 has hired a law firm to file a request to intervene in the ongoing property tax assessment appeal filed by Rivian Automotive that is currently being heard in Springfield. A request to intervene can be filed by a third party in an existing civil matter if that party has a personal stake in the outcome. During a special board meeting on Tuesday, the board voted to hire Reif Schrum, Cantor, and Gutman LLC out of Chicago to represent the district in the upcoming appeal proceedings. Unit 5 Superintendent Kristen Weichel said the filing deadline for such a request would have been the day before the school's board's next regular scheduled meeting, which is why a special meeting had to be called. During a preliminary budget presentation last month, Unit 5 Chief Financial Officer Marty Hickman said the district could be looking at roughly $252 million balanced budget for the 2027 fiscal year. However, the projected revenues could be in jeopardy depending on the outcome of Rivian's assessment appeal. According to Rivian's assessment complaint, which was obtained by the pantograph through the Freedom of Information Act, Rivian's properties were assessed at roughly $175.8 million. Rivian, meanwhile, estimates the total assessed value of its property is about $71.6 million. If the Illinois Property Tax Appeal Board rules in favor of Rivian's valuation of seven different properties, the district could lose about $6.8 million in property tax revenue. The tax overpayments based on an invalidated assessment would then have to be paid back to Rivian from future tax proceedings. Although the appeal process could take months, Weichel said there was no cap on how much the district would pay to the firm. With the potential of $6.6 million to $6.8 million annually, it would be very unlikely that we would spend more in cost than what the potential impact could be to us on an annual basis, Weichel said. A business spotlight. A new Dunkin' Donuts location is set for Market Street in Bloomington, Olivia Jacobs, 22 hours ago. Bloomington. A Dunkin' Donuts location is coming to Bloomington's west side this fall. The coffee franchise is expected to open in November at 1703 West Market Street. Abby Bosman, who works for public relations on behalf of Dunkin', told the Pantograph. Franchisee Haresh Patel said the space is unique because it's only building a Dunkin', so there will not be an adjoining Baskin-Robbins, and it will have the more modern image with new equipment associated with a brand new Dunkin'. The site is a former Chase Bank. We didn't spare $1 on this project. We're really making it nice, fun, and relaxing Dunkin' that everyone can enjoy, Haresh said. I personally always wanted to have a site here. I really thought my opportunity would be the former KFC site across Market Street, but that didn't work out. So we took over the space, which has been unique and challenging from both a layout and construction standpoint. He said that they have put a lot of time and energy and effort into the store, and it will be near completion in October. However, they plan to spend a few weeks focusing on training with the goal of opening sometime in November. Harish said he's excited to see it all come together. You can visit DunkinDonuts.com/locations for more information. Thank you so much for listening today with us, friends. Until next time with part two of the Pantograph, my name is Kayla Verhoeven. Have a great day.